Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to cool people doing interesting things to advance security in some way. I'm your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs, and I am joined by my co-host, the amazing Todd Beardsley.
Hi. Hi.
Live from day three of RSA.
Yep.
Bear in mind that we started recording, I think, at day zero. Or minus one or something, which is why I now have conference voice. Hooray! Which means that I veer between sounding like a certain kind of phone operator and a dirty old man. Hooray! Okay, so with us this week we have my cousin Casey Ellis.
There you go.
CTO and founder of Bugcrowd. Aussie, but we won't hold it against him.
You guys kicked this out, so I don't think you can hold
right,
it against.
Right, which is why now we lose at all sporting events. Yeah, it's terrible. True. You have got your revenge in the long term. And also wielder of Dayglow hair. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. And yes, I am also packing the dulcet baritone of day three of RSA.
Why does it work for you so much better than it does?
I don't know.
It should be a family trait, goddammit. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Keith.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, my extended, I don't know, correct, whatever, fullness title, I started Bugcrowd. That's the one I lead with because it's the piece I'm proudest of.
Congratulations. I hear it's doing very well. You had a big party last night, which people were, like, very excited to go to.
The joke that I make is that we're actually a party and a swag company that has cybersecurity kind of as a side hustle.
Right, no, Rapid7 is also a clothing brand, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a fun thing.
We also make great security products.
Exactly right. Yeah, so, started the company in Australia back in 2012 was when we launched our first programs. I'm also the chairman and now CTO of the company as well.
Congratulations. Chairman sounds pretty fancy.
It's pretty great. Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, the thing that I love about, one of the cool things about RSA is getting to talk to security entrepreneurs that, like, have ideas because folk are always coming up. It's like, yeah, look, I was not doing this before I was doing it. Like, it is possible, like, da-da-da-da. I digress. So what Bugcrowd does is, the original kind of mission statement of the business was to be able to connect the entire potential creative power of the white hat community with the entire problem space that exists in cybersecurity as it evolves. Sure. So both at a point in time, but also there's like new stuff even today that didn't exist when we started that we're hacking on. I view cybersecurity as a fundamentally human problem. The tech just makes it go faster. So this was like, how do we like balance the equation between what's available to the bad guys and what we have from a human resource standpoint? And really the other side of that is that like hackers have been at the table for a long time trying to help, right?
Sure.
But we haven't been invited and it's usually been a pretty hostile response. So like keeping my buddies out of jail was one of the things as well.
It can be a very emotional event, like disclosing bugs on both sides.
Calling someone's baby ugly is like never... never an easy conversation to have proactively, but I think this whole idea of like, building software is hard, to err as human, therefore we need to figure out how we've done that and figure out how not to do it, that's becoming more of a normal idea.
Right, so on that point, I mean, I use the calling babies ugly thing all the time, but the reality is what we need to do is get to a culture where that's not how it's perceived.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
Not saying your baby is ugly. Yep. You're more saying, hey, your baby has some spit up. Maybe we should change it or something. Like, I don't know. Like, it needs to become like a diaper change. And for people not in America, that's nappies.
Is it nappies? No, it was nappies back home and diapers here.
Yeah, that's what I said. People not in America.
I thought it was chips.
No? Freedom fries.
Okay.
Oh dear God. Let's not start this.
Okay. So, I feel like I should have been bowing every time I've seen you now. I didn't. I'm sorry. I feel like I've really been remiss in my duties towards the chairman. So I'll correct it going forward.
That's all right. It's quite all right.
But I want to know, like, Todd has a question that he likes to ask people. I want to know if he's going to lay
it on
you.
Oh, I will.
Shoot. I like these.
So, Casey, in the universe of hacking scenes in movies and TV shows, is there one in particular that speaks to you?
Snake is
the whole thing. I
there was no hesitation as no, well. No, it was very quick.
I've
like
given this a lot of thought, and it's definitely Sneakers.
Well, we're in the right city for it. Sneakers is also the most San Francisco movie ever.
And straight up, I mean,
not the most San Francisco movie ever.
Maybe not ever.
I mean, doesn't Bullet have like a very famous chase scene on the streets of San Francisco? And have you seen The Rock?
Right. I think there's hacking in The Rock, right? no, I mean, like crossing, like literally crossing the San Mateo Bridge for the first time after we came out here. You know, we did an accelerator program. Yeah, and I was like, oh, this is the bridge. Like, this is the bridge. This is amazing.
Oh my God, is that why you chose San Francisco? That's why.
It was just a nice. I mean, I came here like San Francisco is like Hollywood for an actor. Do you know what I mean? Like, this place is crazy, and there's lots of things that aren't great about it, but there's lots of things that are very unique because it's been doing high tech for the longest, really. And it was kind of always the plan. Like, my wife and I, you know, we wanted to live somewhere else at some point. And we both loved San Francisco just as a city. And, you know, as I started getting into the startup thing, I'm like, I want to see inside the belly of the beast and get access to, you know, the different things, like the resource from a VC standpoint, all of that. But then it's more than that. It's like early adopters, like people that have done this stuff for a really long time. You know, I like to think that I'm pretty good at asking the right dumb questions and figuring out which parts of the answer to discard. Uh-huh. And you can do a lot of that here. Cool. Yeah. Is that so Sneakers, yeah.
Yes. I give you that 100%.
It's I mean, I think looking back on it too, right? It's like such a savant movie. I don't know. I got into hacking because I just really enjoy thinking like a criminal, but I don't want to be one.
Sure.
So yeah. And I think there's
to be fair, an orange jumpsuit would clash very badly with your hair.
And also I'm Australian, so the shoe fits pretty cleanly.
That's true. You don't want to just be like a cliche. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's a little cliche, but it does actually make a lot of sense. I think different people get into security in different ways. Like, folk come in from risk, you know, finance even. Folk come in because they're just computer scientists and they want to make computers bend to their will. For me, it's the computer science part, but the stronger thing is that I'm just fascinated by almost the entrepreneurship of being a criminal, and the patterns of thinking that come behind that. But then at the same time, I've got no desire whatsoever. You know, the do no harm thing is something that I take pretty seriously. So, okay, how do you like reconcile that? And it turns out we've got this industry that lets us do that. Uh-huh. So that's how I got started.
So tell us a little bit about, well, actually, let's do the quick 30 seconds on Bug Crowd.
Sure. The spiel.
Good jumping off.
We haven't gotten to that, but for sure. So what Bug Crowd is, we've assembled a platform where we run vuln disclosure programs, we run bug bounty programs, and then what we do is we actually take the fact that we can attract people to the platform using those public models to learn about what they can do, how much we can trust them, how professional are they, where are they from, all of that sort of stuff, and basically carve up the crowd in different ways to deliver private crowdsource testing in all sorts of different forms. And really, you know, the idea from it, I ran a pen test company in Australia, was a pen tester for about 7 years and then moved into solution architecture and sales and broke bad and did the startup thing. And the company before Bug Crowd was a pen testing firm. And I was looking at it thinking, all right, like, firstly, the margin that's achievable in this space is insane. If everyone's walking away from this happy, then something's systemically wrong. And that's eventually going to get to a breaking point. I'm like, well, maybe I can be that breaking point. That could be cool. But the other side of it was...
Life goals.
Yeah, life goals, squad goal. The other side of it was this idea of, you know, if we've got, like, a crowd of people building software, and going back to that, like, yeah, it's... Mistakes are human. They're not... Yeah, you know, I think you were spot on before, the whole idea of, like, the security team or the security people having the tendency to call people stupid. It's like, well, have you built a platform and maintained it? I'm not sure that you have. And, you know, and it's the same in the opposite direction. So, yeah, the whole idea of, like, this crowd building software, there being mistakes, and this crowd of people trying to attack it maliciously, and then you got, like, Bob or Jane the pen tester and whatever tooling they've got available to them, right? The tooling's awesome, but it's never going to be as creative as the human to get into that gap. So how do you balance it out? So that was really, you know, the idea of it. You know, normalizing disclosure, normalizing, you know, the idea that, like, hackers are locksmiths too. We're not just burglars. That was a part of what we needed. I knew we needed to do to be able to see the thing grow. And that's, honestly, that side of it is the part that I'm actually proudest of. Like, there wasn't anything else around when we started. And that, to me, has shifted. Like, we've cleared I don't think everyone views hackers that way yet, but we're definitely over the hump of that being consensus.
Oh, I think in the years since the crowd was founded, I think that we have seen a huge evolution. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, we had a letter from the Department of Justice in support of security research.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a milestone.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. So it's cool to be a part of that. Like, I'm you know, very proud of what we've done and all of that, but it's honestly been a privilege to, you know, to be a part of, like, this evolution of what's going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree on that front as well. So tell us about Disclosed.io, which is really cool.
Yeah, for sure. So this is the project piece. So what we did in 2016, actually a little bit before that, we recognized that, you know, researchers don't tend to read legal language, mm-hmm. right?
What?
It's true, like, shock horror. And also, we were, like, having this, you know, net new, like, there's the OG people that have done VR and disclosure and stuff like that, and then there's this kind of new talent pool that's come in that don't really have the history or the empathy of, like, the 30 years that's led up to this, right? They don't read the brief, and they don't understand the legal context of it.
I mean, no one reads terms of service, let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, how do we make that simpler and more consumable and then standardize it so you can reduce it almost to a logo that becomes like a, oh, okay, they've got like a neighborhood watch sticker on their mailbox. I get it. But then what we did the year before last was to recognize the fact that, yep, CFAA is not going to change anytime soon. Anti-hacking laws are being hotly debated in all sorts of ways.
So for those who are listening who have apparently never listened before, because I talk about it all the time, the CFAA is the...
Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Which is the main anti-hacking law in the US.
Yep.
And a really big problem with the CFAA is that it doesn't define consent.
And the idea, I think, really the core of it is that it sort of assumes bad faith. Like this whole idea of like a hacker is a good person too. Anyone who attempts unauthorized access, if you're doing that, you're automatically viewed as having...
It doesn't. You have to prove mens rea. That's a basic for US law, which basically means you have to prove bad intent. I'm sorry, you got the law nerd
here. I got
here.
The Esquire.
Yes, you got there. Yes, you did. You That's got amazing. the Juris friggin' Doctorate out, right?
And yeah, completely. You know, we've had a lot of conversations around like the letter of the law. But the CFAA is also very vague, so it comes down to the interpretation and how people use it, which is the part I'm talking
100%.
About.
100%. The CFAA is got a big challenge in it. There's a lot of gray area. But just to be clear on this and to make it also a little bit less just US-centric,
yes.
There is a problem in anti-hacking laws generally whereby the concept of consent on the internet is very tricky because there is a school of thought that if you put something on the internet and make it publicly accessible, mm-hmm. then consent is implied.
Yep.
However, anti-hacking laws all hinge around this concept of authorization, either exceeding authorized access or accessing without authorization.
Yeah.
And people have traditionally tried to lean into things like user agreements as a way of saying whether or not there's authorization, but that doesn't work legally because there's no expectation of people reading user agreements, and in fact, you can't negotiate.
That's a far more eloquent way of laying it out. That's absolutely
the matter
right.
of concept is tricky, and it applies to the CFAA, the CMA in the UK, probably everybody's anti-hacking laws. They're all sort of based on the same kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
So sorry for being bringing out the Esquire.
No, that's. I mean, I appreciate. Because this was my like that was my Lyft driver pitch
yeah.
of the problem, right? And I
right.
think for the audience, that description was
oh my god, I would be a
very
boring Lyft driver. I'd be like, well, let me tell
yeah,
you.
How can you reduce the problem to something that people will understand and then engage with? But yeah, like the nuance of it is exactly as you're saying. That was really well put. So 2016, no one reads the brief. 2018, hang on a sec, like we're testing the limits of this far more frequently because of the rise of bounty and the rise of non-disclosure. We need to start to figure out ways to you know allow companies to align their legal teams, their marketing teams, their PR teams, and then externally, like basically the entire internet, with what is okay and what's not okay.
Yeah.
Because you know the challenge when you go even deeper with that concept of access on the internet is that if the way that you're helping is to like bypass the things that would normally control access, then it gets really funky really quickly. So that's really what Disclose.io, you know, we took the open source repo, we branded it, we put it under that domain, you know, created a logo around it and all of that sort of stuff, and I'll get to that in a bit. And it was the idea of, like, how do you create an easy on button from a boilerplate terminology standpoint for people to either copy and paste or to use as a framework for their legal teams to work with. Because usually what we see when we talk to someone who's never thought about this before, like the security team get it, the legal team completely freak out,
right?
And you end up with War and Peace, right? Yeah. And you've got to work it back from there. we wanted to skip that. Yeah. So that's that was the idea on the actual language itself. Like it's here for the US. We've got like a genericized version that talks about, you know, any hacking laws, any circumvention laws, a la DMCA, but whatever else might be equivalent to that globally.
Oh, so the DMCA is the?
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which means if you circumvent a control that's intended to prevent a behavior within software that you actually own. So it's the difference between someone else's computer and something that runs as software or a computer that is yours. That's when that comes in and affects people doing security research. So all of that stuff, like being able to then transport that into different countries, different languages, like the goal, and this is really the call to action for people that are listening, you know, folks that have a legal background that understands how this stuff works. Like, I'm not a lawyer. I play one on TV, but I'm very open about
you
admitting
do?
Not to be. Well, yeah.
Which shows are you in?
Bug Crowd, the Bug Crowd show.
I love that show. I know, went really downhill after the first season.
We haven't got a theme song yet, but we should work on that. Yeah, like the whole idea of, you know, it's open source. Like the whole idea is like this is actually, obviously Bug Crowd benefits from this shift in how it all works, right? It makes life easier for us as a business. But it's also something that we want to see happen anyway. So, okay, how do you open source it? How do you, like, encourage contribution, collaboration, consensus, adoption? And that's why the logo's there, because the whole idea of, you know, my thought on this and the master plan is to get it to the point where, you know, Joe or Jane Internet is seeing this and saying, oh, that's Neighborhood Watch for the Internet. I understand that. Right. And it becomes a positive driver for a company to adopt something like this instead of just, oh, I don't know if we want to talk to hackers or not.
So the text of the, you know, the things that you're producing on Disclose IR, are they short enough that I can just like chuck it into a README in a GitHub repo, or are they more GPL length?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, because like the idea is, because it's not just, it's like, how do you make it as legally complete as possible whilst keeping it brief and then accommodating for the fact that most of your audience is English as a second language? Mm-hmm. Or isn't the native language of the text itself. So that's going to, like, when we start doing stuff, you know, in Russia, for example, that's going to get really interesting. And it's an interesting enough problem here, you know, in the English language, because brevity tends to trade itself off against the legal completeness of a thing. And really it's more, you know, in terms of the actual prosecutions, like any language that's proactively put out onto a website by a company is a very strong negative signal of the fact that company is going to cloud up and rain on a security researcher. Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation we've had with the EFF a lot. It's like, well, you know, how accurate does this need to be legally? Or is the thing that's more important, you know, is
just the signal that you're accepting of this?
Yeah, because if it gets on the website, there's a lot of people that go into that decision, and you get organizational alignment as a byproduct of the path to that. So there's all of these like weird dynamics that we're trying to balance out behind the scenes. But yeah, the end game is for it to be something where, you know, someone can see it, they can understand the concept of Neighborhood Watch, right? And at that point, it's not about hackers anymore. It's just like, oh, okay, they're getting feedback from the internet. That's a good thing. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how one of the things that I really like about it is that you do have versions in other languages and you are trying to sort of tailor to other countries' needs.
Sure.
How many countries have you now covered?
Yeah, at this point, it's Canada and the US. We're working actively on Australia, the UK, and Spain.
Nice.
And yeah, it's straight up like this is, you know, one of those things within Bug Crowd. There's people that work on it within Bug Crowd. It's not like a core mission thing, so it's like as much.
Do you have external people in the community working on it as well?
Yes, we do. Yeah,
that's great.
So, and the goal is for that to be able to grow. So, for people to push on the repo, say, "Hey, I don't like that word. You know, I think we should use responsible instead of coordinated or
good
whatever."
Good lord,
I mean, that would a conversation would ensue, hard, and then that would be on record, right? So that's
no,
the part
I don't
that's
advocate
important.
Violence. People say responsible. Okay, so and do you like? Are you talking to the governments of those countries? Do they
get involved? Yeah. So the thing that's been interesting interesting with this is the whole conversation. We got drawn into election security about 18 months ago by the House Rules Committee, and we've been, you know, working since with the National Association of State Secretaries. Some
election
of the states.
Security. I haven't heard much about that. Is that a big topic?
It's like this hot new thing. Apparently, I don't know. Like democracy could catch
on. I'm excited to solve it by 2024.
So. Here's my bad business idea of the week. Right, instead of like looking at putting voting on the blockchain, let's just turn the election into an ICO.
Sure.
Right. Why like not? If a candidate beats the price of Bitcoin, then they win. Uh-huh. Like, that's awesome. Perfect. No one do that, please. Yeah. That was a joke. the whole idea of, National Association of State Secretaries, the states themselves, and others, and this is where it kind of comes together. Like, the main risk, I think, for 2020 is disinformation. Like, we're kind of out of time to do much more on the security front, and we still can, so don't hear what I'm not saying there. Like, to me, the bigger threat and the bigger risk is the idea of, you know, people that want to manipulate the outcome or undermine confidence in democracy itself, calling out computer security as a reason not to vote and a reason not to trust the government. Yeah. And I see vuln disclosure and just the idea of it being there as something that's easy enough to communicate to a layperson voter that it can actually help with that. Yeah. So that's kind of the big play there. It's a bit of a long bow, but when you kind of run through it, it's like, oh, that does actually make sense. Like, democracy is a crowd thing, and we've got a crowd of hackers to help out with stuff. So, like, plug them in together, and let's see what we can do.
So how many do you have a sense of how many people have adopted it?
Yeah, we're going to tweak the stat again at the end of this week. So we've got a list. So the other thing that's on Disclosure is like literally a crowdsourced list of every known vulnerability disclosure program, which again is open source, and that's actually being contributed to by the community.
It's great.
There's about, I think, 900 programs on there right now. And
that's
last,
great.
Yeah, it's good. Last time I looked at it, it was about 30% that had adopted like full, what we refer to as full safe harbor language. And really the idea of that is like, if you do these things, you are authorized, and therefore, you know, stuff like CFAA becomes more difficult to prosecute versus partial safe harbor, which is basically, hey, we won't be jerks. If you know, they still could be as a company.
You can trust us, honest.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I describe that as the difference between, like, in California, the speed limits are more kind of speed recommendations.
Yeah.
And that's like consensus.
Yep.
That's the difference between partial and full. So if the speed limit was to actually be raised, that would be the equivalent of full in this sense.
Yep. So for those paying attention, he just sidestepped the question of how many people.
30% of 900, which is 300. I didn't sidestep it. What are you talking about?
Wait. Oh, so you've got 300 people have adopted it. That's really awesome. Yeah. I'm sorry, maybe my brain just couldn't go with
it's
that.
It's day 3 of RSA.
I'm like, is it bedtime again? that's awesome. So then all of that sounds very rosy and like it's all gone very well.
What has
it? Yeah, right. I don't believe it's all been smooth sailing.
Not at all. No, I mean, consensus is hard to get, especially like of all of the topics in cybersecurity that's hard to get consensus around, like vulnerability disclosure, I think is the...
There are no opinions. I don't know what you're talking about.
There's absolutely no opinions. There are no...
But while I've got you here, I've got some thoughts on this.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, so I think, you know, language is hard. Like I mentioned before, the conversation with EFF and other folk where it's like, okay, how... Because we had... Promptly had a bunch of lawyers come up and say, well, that doesn't fully cover like this edge case and that edge case and the other, at which point we had to have that conversation. And that, you know, that was heavy because lawyers are lawyers and they know stuff. And it's like, okay, we have to actually balance this out and have them understand what we're trying to achieve, which is not like complete legal completeness. By the way, is that okay? We should probably like triple check that.
Right.
That whole process, I wouldn't say that hasn't gone well. It's just been a blip
I'd imagine it was slow.
Yeah, it's been one of those ones where it's like, okay, we've had to grind our way through that part. There's different opinions on even the use of the word safe harbor.
Yep. I'm just scrolling through all your old pull requests on that topic. It's fascinating.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten pretty animated in there already, which is like, it's the point. Like, let's get people talking about this, and as a byproduct of that conversation, oh, hang on a sec, are we doing this? We should do it, because that's like the end game.
So can you lay out what the concerns are around the use of the word safe harbor?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in, so what, I've heard is, oh, well, hackers are going to interpret that to mean immunity to any kind of prosecution whatsoever, and they've got carte blanche to do what they want. As the main risk, which I can see happening, especially with like newer players. To me, that's one of those ones where, well, hang on a sec, if safe harbor is a term that the person implementing the policy can understand more quickly because of the use of that term, then we kind of get past that problem because it, like, it becomes normalized.
Yeah.
So that's like the trade-off there. Do you know what
it
I mean?
It is. I mean, certainly in the conversations around, you know, what a carve-out for security research might look like in an anti-hacking law, the concept of inadvertently creating, if you will, a backdoor to the law for criminals is certainly one of the like the big concerns. And it's even, you know, with the safe harbor concept, it's even further than researchers believing that anything goes. And it's like people masquerading as researchers and getting away with other things.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's a really good call out. So that's another you know, thing to be able to market through and explain to people. It's like, no, it's not, hey, you can just hack us, YOLO.
Yeah.
It's all good. Because that's not
so many tech vendors do live by YOLO. Yeah.
Well, we're in the city of YOLO, so yeah. Because really the way that it works is it's like a conditional if this then that statement. So if you we will do these things, and by the way, you are, you know, authorized and exempted and so on. So, like, the precursor is the if statement. If you go outside those lines,
that is the important thing.
Yeah, that becomes the definition of good faith that's set out by the company writing the policy. And what we tried to do with Skozo is get that to as sane a middle ground as possible. It's like, okay, these are the things that, like, yeah, you should. There's this, you know, the whole conversation around, oh, you know, should there even be scope in you know, vulnerable disclosure, or is it just the organization itself? I believe it should ultimately be everything that affects the entity, but different people are at different stages of being able to accept that
and,
idea and do
and,
that.
You know, incremental progress, baby steps.
Exactly. And the goal is to get it to the point where it's just, hey, you know what, if you see something, say something, and that's fine. Like, that's the end state that I want to get to.
It sounds familiar. Like, I feel like I've heard it somewhere.
It's from this agency that has really awesome stickers. Yeah, I think so.
One of the other criticisms or concerns I've heard with Safe Harbor is that if you draw a box around a set of activities and say everything in this box is okay, then do you over time create an expectation or an understanding that anything outside that box is inherently considered to be bad or at least shady?
You end up with that dichotomy, right? Like, even if it wasn't expressed, it's implied.
This is definitely something that I've heard one of my favorite people, Kurt Opsahl, GC of the EFF, has raised as a concern in the past.
100%. Yeah, I've talked to Kurt about that too. And
in fact, over lunch with me.
Yeah, there you go. he's got a really good point. You know, it's one of these ones where if we get that kind of criticism or that kind of critical feedback, it's like, okay, help me understand the nature of the angle that you're viewing the problem from, and like, let's work out how that reconciles with the end goal that we're trying to achieve. And is that kind of an inherent part of the next step? Which I sort of think it is. Like, the whole idea of a dichotomy that already existed informally. You know, we've helped thousands of companies establish these policies at this point. So the idea of, like, okay, you know, defining good behavior, like, there are norms forming around what is okay, acceptable research anyway, as a function of this being a novel space that's being adopted pretty quickly. So to me, it's one of those hazards that's like, okay, how do we navigate, like, given the fact that, like, new social norms tend to do that, period.
Right.
How do we actually steer that? How do we get to a point where we can steer that and influence over time?
I mean, again, I think, you know, much as we were saying before, it's about incremental progress.
Yeah.
And you take the space that you can occupy safely now, and you safeguard around the other spaces. And try and be vigilant and think about how you adapt over that time.
And what I suspect will happen, because this has, I mean, this already happens in Bounty Land when it comes to, you know, people going out of scope.
Bounty Land, one of my favorite places.
Bounty Land, we do have a theme song for that.
There's skipping, there's rainbows, unicorns.
There's a merry-go-round, and it goes around and around and around. But you know, the idea of like a company running a private program, and then there's someone that submits an issue to them, and they're like, "Well, hang on a sec, this is a private program, but that's not the same as a disclosure program." So how do you like? There's all of these different things that are kind of starting to surface now as things that need to be normalized,
right?
And need to be better understood. And we're just in the process of like evolving from one thing to the next. So I think it's really a matter of being mindful. Again, coming back to like, what's the North Star?
Yeah.
Like, what do we want to hit, right? And then reconciling whatever those like hiccups might be towards that North Star, and being vigilant for them. Because if it ends up, oh, you know what, you didn't do blah 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 according to disclose.io, like you're a criminal.
No, I mean that's how I act. Yeah, I always say that to people. Yeah.
I can get a little legalistic sometimes.
I say it particularly to Todd on the regular.
But that, I mean, Todd, you know, you need to right. need to rally in sometimes.
No, absolutely.
So I kind of expect that to happen.
Yeah.
At different points in time. So it's just a matter of how do you get it back on track.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's a great project, Casey. I'm super happy that we have people, advocating for security research and trying to think about how we make this stuff easier and more consistent and more streamlined, and how we, you know, over time adapt the relationship, make it more healthy between vendors and researchers. So thank you for everything you're doing on that front. If you could offer, just as your final thought, your sort of Jerry Springer moment, if you could offer a sort of like, you know, single learning or piece of advice to people who are launching their own projects, trying to build consensus, that kind of stuff. Obviously, avoid the word responsible as one of them, but
yeah, act responsibly. it's all about community. It's like, you know, all the brains I have and all the brains I can borrow, right? So it's being
nice. How many brains do you have?
A few, but I've borrowed more.
In boxes.
I've borrowed
jars,
far more.
Right, yeah.
I collect them. No, that gets creepy quick. So the whole idea of, you know, I think security can be kind of an introverted space, and this idea of like, hey, I've got this idea. Like, folk that haven't done that before find it really intimidating to do. And the part I don't think a lot of them realize is that there's folk that actually think that what you're trying to do is awesome, and you will get a lot of help if you ask for it. So it's like, you know, build community to whatever degree you can. And then, as I said before, like, ask people dumb questions, you know, figure out which parts of the answer apply to what you're doing and which parts don't, and integrate that into what you know.
I agree. I think that's awesome. I think it is a great note to finish on. Casey, thank you so much for joining us, despite the fact that we all feel a little bit like we're half dead.
And it's mostly your fault because of your party.
I'm sorry.
He was blaming me over text messages this morning, so you know, you're fine. Whichever Ellis he can pick on, he will.
This is definitely an Ellis.
LS-based
blame. Yep.
Awesome. I hope that you will come on again in the future and give us an update on
absolutely.
It. We would love that. And again, thank you for everything.
Absolutely. Cool. Cheers.
So thank you so much to Casey for being our special guest during RSA, which is no longer now, in case you've been asleep for a really long time and you weren't aware.
It was in the before times, even.
It was the before times. It was BC, before COVID. And Casey is now in Australia and I am in the UK. So much has changed. So what's happening in the world?
From the start, because this was our Casey Ellis talk, I did want to talk about online voting. Specifically, the march toward online voting as seen from the point of view of votes. VOATZ, which, you know, that name should just inspire that appropriate level of confidence in handling online balloting. It is so goofball, Jen. I can't even get over it. So over the last week or so, they've had this like on again, off again Twitter campaign to like, no, say basically, no, we're legit and we can totally do this. It's very much on the heels of COVID-19, you know, people and like the disastrous election that happened in Wisconsin. That had, you know, in Wisconsin, the polling places in Milwaukee went from 130 polling places to 5 on the day of.
Yikes.
And it was bonkers, you know, super long line, several hours hanging out with a bunch of strangers during a full blown pandemic. It made me livid. But see, here's the thing, is like the solution to this is ballot by mail. And I know ballot by mail, like up and down the board, is really hard. You're dealing with like a giant population you've never had to deal with before. That said, ballot by mail has been the thing for, you know, overseas people who happen to be overseas, people who are gone for other reasons. You know, the military, the entire military votes this way, by the way.
I mean, that's a bold assumption that the entire military votes, but yeah, sure.
Sure.
those in the military who are deployed overseas and vote.
Yeah. The ones who are deployed military votes this way, which, you know, in recent history tends to be a lot of people. You know, and when you're, as far as from what I hear, when you're in the military, you will take every opportunity to break up your routine at all. So voting is like one of those few things they get to do, that they feel connected to, like, American
society.
Which
is a good way of thinking about it. I was going on the postal votes a pain and massively reduces the number of people who vote kind of a thing, which I think is where you were starting from.
It is. So, like, it's not perfect. You know, and moving from, you know, a, let's say, 8% turnout, if that, even, from vote by mail to 100%, like, everyone who votes by mail, will be a task. Like, that will be a huge thing. But it's also a pandemic and it's a crisis and, like, you know, desperate times and desperate measures and all that. And here's the thing is, like, and let's bring this back around to votes. What votes is doing now is, they are undercutting any kind of vote by mail argument. And it's just so naked and transparent. Just go look at their Twitter feed, for the last couple of weeks when you hear this. It is, you know, twitter.com/VOATZ. And they are just saying these bonkers things about, like, oh, voting by mail is insecure and voting by mail, like, exposes your personal identification, you know, PII and all that. And it's hard and people don't want to do it, you know, all in the service of, like, have you tried our vote by internet solution over here? Which is crazy because they just came off of an audit from Trail of Bits that exposed a few dozen issues with their solution. And I do like voting on the internet. I do think that voting on the internet is going to be a thing. It's inevitable. We will be doing it. We will not be doing it with votes. You know, full stop. They just don't have the solution for it today. I mean, and I think that's kind of a foregone conclusion among security people, which is why votes is now turning to attack security people directly.
Oh, that's a good sign. It always goes well when that happens.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to my personal attack from votes. We'll see after this airs. Depends on how many people listen to this. But they are so West Virginia, the Secretary of State there seems to like votes. I guess it's okay to have like one state try it out because that's like the kind of half the point of a federated country is that you have these laboratories of democracy and like what works one place might work other places, but let's find out. But that said, like, I don't know, man, like it seems like votes is just not, they don't have like the cryptographic chops. They certainly don't have the trust of like basically anyone on in security. And now they're like pulling the skeezy playbook of like, oh, well, let's just like diss security researchers and let's like diss, you know, vote by mail, which is a totally valid solution, even though it's hard. You know, at this point in April during a pandemic, I think vote by mail is an easier lift than vote by internet. You know, and that's just how the way the world works. Just my opinion, man.
and you've held back on it so far otherwise in this gripping episode.
I am annoyed with this company and the way they're handling like crisis comms, with the way they're handling Mark, because I know what good crisis comms looks like.
You smooth talker, you. It will totally work. Yeah, I mean, definitely they seem to be in the school of self-serving marketing shenanigans, and not really thinking about the fact that, like, you know, if you're a company that is selling a product for voting, then probably what you should care about more than anything is the sanctity of elections. And so when you go around trying to undermine public confidence in elections, that basically makes you a bad guy. That makes you skeezy. It means that you don't really care about the thing that you're saying you care
about.
You
have skulls on your lapels at that point. Like, that is, it is impossible to be the good guy in this situation.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. There's a question, a distinct question mark over that piece of activity.
So yeah, and speaking of bad guys,
yeah,
you can go get an index of them. Not really, but if you go to Attacker KB, this is a product that mostly Metasploit folks, but like a whole bunch of other Rapid7 folks worked on, you know, UX wise and all that. About ranking vulnerabilities as they appear to be in the eyes of an attacker.
Wait, this is not a product though, right? This is a, like, it's more of an open source, like...
Oh yeah, it's super free and everything.
Anybody can contribute knowledge, isn't this right? So...
Yes. It is, well, I mean, I would call it a product because it has been produced by Rapid7. So like, just that's how grammar works. it's not for sale or anything like that. So, it's Attacker KB. If you Google Attacker KB, you'll find it. If you just go to attackerkb.com, you'll find it. And what this is it's basically a crowdsourced approach to like criticality and severity and risk calculations. This is an area of computer security that we're actually not that great at, because like cryptographers, for example, might say like, oh, this crypto bug is like super, super bad. But then, you know, somebody else, an engineer, might look at it and think like, well, what do you get out of this anyway? Like, okay, you get this one secret, but who cares? You know, that kind of thing. And so
just to clarify, when you say mm-hmm. we are not super good at it, you mean humans. You don't mean specifically Rapid7.
Yeah, no. Rapid7 is awful at this. You should go somewhere else. No. We as a culture and civilization are not great at this. I don't know about species. The species were actually pretty good at risk. but yeah, as an online culture, as in the dawn of the digital age here, which we still are in, we are bad at this. So we can, you know, we can go over there, and basically the whole premise here is that if we crowdsource it among researchers, among pen testers, among like just anyone with a GitHub account, basically, we can probably kind of get into the zone of truth. It may not be perfect, but it is certainly better than a single number. This is like a long complaint about something like the CVSS scoring system, where it boils down vulnerability severity to a number, which is nonsense because vulnerabilities live in many dimensions. And, you know, when you're just going down to one point, like you lose a lot of context. So this gives you context. There's a lot of like written, like you can do like natural language processing on a lot of the, on a lot of like the short write-ups that people are providing here. There's a really nice API. So if you want to do this automatically, or you want to bring in the results automatically, you can. And so it's not just like a web page. It's a web page with a API with designed with like use in mind, right? It's not just kind of like glommed on after the fact just for this website. It is, the API is solid and well tested and should hook into pretty much any kind of software application that you might build to consume something like this, right? Which is really like, I am literally hand waving very rapidly right now. But yeah, it's cool. And so check it out, especially if you care about like vulnerabilities that are in the news. This promises to be the kind of place where you can look and say like, oh, well, that Zoom bug is like no big deal.
You can't help yourself, can you? Uh-huh. Any opportunity to get on that Zoom bandwagon yet again and be like, oh, I mentioned
it's
my Zoom,
the Zoom anti-bandwagon. or to say like, oh, that Zoom bug is actually a big deal, you know, something like that, you know, so you can, and like we pull in from, you know, Microsoft Tuesday patches, specifically, like fairly automatically at this point. So yeah, take a look. It's pretty cool.
So I think the general gist is, one, If you're dealing with vulnerabilities in any way, if you're trying to figure out how much you should care about them, that kind of thing, it's definitely worth going and looking at it. But two, if you deal with vulnerabilities from the other point of view, as in like you have a point of view yourself on how bad they are, like either you're a pen tester and you're using them, or you are a defender and you're managing them, mitigating them, like contribute to the knowledge base. Like it all yeah. creates that rising tide that raises all ships. That is pretty much the goal of this thing. So yeah, check it out. Attacker KB. And as Todd said, if you Google it, it will appear.
First it.
Hooray. Yep. All right. Well, thanks very much, Todd. This was awesome. As usual, I feel educated, and also like weirdly angry at votes now.
That's okay. Just go with that feeling. Embrace it.
I totes dislike votes. There you go. So I have to go and shake my head at myself for a while. And on that note, thank you to our special guest, Casey Ellis, who is not related to me, that we can prove, but we still enjoy telling everyone he is. Thank you to Todd, who is not related to me, and I don't tell anyone that he is. And thank you to our amazing producer, Bree, who wishes she'd never met either of us. Uh-huh. And we will speak to you soon. Hooray!